Welcome, everyone, and thank you for being here post lunch. Session 7E will look to kick off. So, this session today, Climate Accountability in Action, Managing Risk Reporting Across Australian Entities. I'm Aidan Nguyen, chairing today's session. With me today, and I'm pleased to introduce the two presenters, we've got Alyssa Cruikshank, who leads the accounting and financial reporting practice at Sign Advisory, where she helps clients navigate new accounting standards, and in particular, climate reporting. She'll be joined by her colleague, Soumya Ohri, who is an actuary at Sign, collaborates with Alyssa on mandatory climate reporting, in particular, the quantitative aspects, like strategy, metrics and targets, and pillars of the standard. Before we get underway, we'll just start as we always do, by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands and waters in which we work, live and work, travel and trade, pay our respects to members, those communities, elders past and present, and recognise and celebrate those their continuing custodianship and culture. So with that, pleased to hand over to Alyssa. The floor's yours.
Thank you so much, Aidan, for that introduction. As Aidan mentioned, I'm Alyssa Cruikshank, and I lead the accounting advisory and financial reporting practice at Sign Advisory. I am truly honoured to be here today to discuss mandatory climate reporting with all of you. I know we're a small crowd, but quality over quantity, I always say. I'm sure all of us are aware of the climate emergency across the globe. We have seen this in extreme weather across Australia and internationally. Australia as a nation is taking significant steps to transition to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. My slides have gone too fast. The Australian government has set targets to reduce emissions by 62% to 70% by below the 2005 levels by 2035. This is an extremely ambitious target that not only requires structural changes to industries, but also clear and accurate reporting to drive accountability over these reductions. And this is where mandatory climate reporting comes in. The National Greenhouse Gas, Greenhouse Energy and Reporting Act was the first step in the shift towards mandatory and uniform reporting. The NGER scheme provides a single reporting framework for corporations that meet specific thresholds to register and report annually to the Clean Energy Regulator. In addition to NGERs, we now have the introduction of the Australian Sustainability Reporting Standards, specifically climate-related disclosures, or AASB S2. With it, we are shifting towards the disclosure of climate-related impacts being mandatory in an organization's annual report alongside its audited financial information. This will mean more direct accountability to the public beyond just reporting to the regulator. And this is where I really see the importance of reporting, because without accountability, we are not going to get to net zero. This slide gives us a snapshot of where we are across Australia in terms of the progress towards mandatory climate reporting. Some key takeaways are the private sector entities established under the Corporations Act have a phased rollout of disclosure requirements based on thresholds. Importantly, the AASB has an ongoing project to tailor the AASB S2 guidance to not-for-profit and public sector context. So despite this, we have seen a really divergent approach across the states and territories, because there is an expectation that we will all get towards climate reporting. In absence of concrete guidance, as I said, all geographies have taken different approaches. The Commonwealth and the New South Wales government has been undoubtedly the most proactive and progressive in the adoption of AASB S2. And have reporting requirements from FY24. So they're already in effect. And there's also phased assurance requirements with that. South Australia and Victoria have not yet provided guidance on how they will apply AASB S2. They individually have their own prescribed reporting requirements in relation to emissions, but they're not completely tailored and aligned to AASB S2. One thing to note, in Victoria, the Auditor General's office have said that they are going to be doing performance audits on emissions reporting, and they're going to be starting with water entities. But it is expected that all government entities are going to be looked at. Queensland, WA, and the Northern Territory have not yet provided an indication of their plans for implementation of AASB S2. But as mentioned previously, it is expected there will be progress towards implementing this new standard. The pressure is definitely on the public sector to practice what they preach. We're asking for net zero. We're asking for progress towards it. We need to show accountability in meeting those targets so that we're on track. So we're now going to take a deeper dive into the specifics of climate reporting so you can better understand how it can apply to your organization and specifically injury and disability schemes. I was listening to a great presentation by Taylor Fry before, run by Roberta, on basically what the impact of the increase in temperature is actually having on heat-related accidents and the claims associated with it. And what Roberta talked through is actually, like, you know, we can see the increase in these incidents in the workplace. One of the really difficult things with that is, how do we actually then quantify it? So what is that cost to your organization of climate risk? And increase in claims is one aspect, but there is a range of impacts across an organization in terms of the actual financial exposure attached to those risks. And that is something that is very, very interesting. Another kind of key thing that I do find quite interesting for this is that this is an accounting standard that's driving the disclosures that we're making, but it is very unique in that it is an accounting standard that relates to information that is very much not in your typical finance system. So the accountability for that becomes quite complicated. And really, it's not just your kind of finance team that's going to own this information. It is so important to have a collaborative approach to implementing mandatory climate reporting. It's not going to just fall on the CFO to sign off on this information. It's going to be really down to the business to also understand it. And with AASB S2, it is unique as well from an accounting standard perspective in that it covers quite a distinct range of things. The numbers are just one part of it. The biggest, like the kind of cornerstone and what you start with, is around your risk and governance framework. So how do you actually set that up to properly have people accountable for climate change? You also have your strategy, and that's like, basically, it's not just strategy as a segregated part of your business in terms of what's our strategy towards getting to net zero, but it's actually, how do you embed that in your organizational strategy in the short, medium, and long term? But one of the things here on this, the assurance timeline, is you'll see that it is very much a phased approach to having reasonable assurance. And what this means is that your auditors, they're being given like basically a 4-year time horizon to basically get up to speed so that they can give reasonable assurance. And that's great for them because they can, you know, adjust their methodology and really tailor their audit procedures to so that they can write in their audit report, we're giving reasonable assurance on your climate disclosures. On the other hand, though, management is still going to need to be extremely comfortable with the numbers that they're putting in their financial statement. And your boards and your audit committees are also going to have that level of comfort. From what we've seen, a lot of times boards and audit and risk committees are quite uncomfortable with that level of ambiguity, especially because we were really at the starting point of even gathering a lot of this data on what are your climate risks, how do you quantify them. how do you actually track your emissions? And Swami's going to be going into more detail on it later on, but scope one and two are just one part of the equation. Eventually, you're going to have to report on scope three, which is basically your emissions throughout your whole supply chain. And that is extremely complicated. So there's definitely a lot of questions coming from boards and audit committees on how do we have comfort over the numbers that you're going to be putting in our annual report. One of the things is that they have issued a modified director's declaration, and this basically covers from 2025 to 27, which is great in that it says you have to take reasonable steps to complying with AASB S2 and the Corps Act, but you still need to take reasonable steps. And obviously that will depend on your level of maturity through the process, but there is definitely an expectation that you're going to be able to sign off on these numbers. So yeah, I think like the main takeaway here, I would say, is that it is going to be a long process. Most organizations are at different stages because of the very difference in application, across the country and also internationally. But the expectation is that we are going to need to report on this. So I'm just going to hand it over to Soumya now, who's going to take us through a bit more about the journey towards mandatory climate reporting and how it particularly can apply to the industry.
Thanks, Alyssa. Right. What I wanted to do as part of this session was to make it as action-oriented as I can. So instead of stating the requirements, what we have done here on this slide is converted the requirements to key activities within each pillar that need to be performed and the key outputs that you produce within each pillar. And also in subsequent slides, I also have insights all the way through. So again, make it very action-oriented and actually leave you with things to do and things to consider as you go on this journey. Alrighty, thank you. Before I go into the activities that need to be performed within each pillar of the mandatory climate reporting standard or legislations, the first step is preparation. What we have often found works best in our experience is, as a right off the bat, do a gap analysis. What are the requirements? What do you need to do? And what are the current gaps in your processes, data, systems? Basically, how do you get there? And what helps after you've identified the gaps is to then understand the relevance of those gaps and the materiality of those gaps. Because once you've understood that, what that would then help is for you to prioritize in what order you then fill those gaps, which is then what makes an implementation plan. And that's quite important to do because it's a long journey. It's not going to happen within a few months, I would say. There's a long pathway to actually filling those gaps. And putting in on a plan helps, not just internally, but also as you present to your board, because board buy-in is quite important. We have found that senior executives and board are not completely across the requirements. They might not be completely across the complexity of the requirements. So taking them through those and the key activities that need to be performed and actually getting the buy-in from them from the right off the start is quite important. Once that's happened, the key activities within each of the pillars, the first one being the governance. Again, what we have realized in our experience that a top-down approach for governance is quite useful, which is basically establishing board oversight. Have the right conversations with them from the very start. Like, let them know you are eligible, from when are you eligible, what are the key requirements, what will they need to see and approve over a period of time. And then creating the climate working group. Now, within that group, what we have seen again is a multidisciplinary group is quite important. So your CROs, your CFOs, your sustainability officers need to all come together to actually figure out the requirements and implement them internally. And then performing a skills and capability assessment within your organization. What needs to be achieved and how would it be achieved? But also more broadly, establishing the roles and responsibilities, like who owns the data, who owns certain process, who owns the risk assessment, who owns the scenario analysis, who owns which part of the reporting. It's very difficult to agree that with the stakeholders because oftentimes they also wouldn't realize that this is an area that they would need to eventually own. And then coming up with an uplift plan across the board as to what needs to be, what capabilities need to be uplifted. The next one, strategy. This is an area that I believe actuaries can really play a role because it's very quantitative. It's future looking. You need to run climate scenarios out to 100 years, and you really need to understand the impact of climate on your organization over a long period of time in the future, which I believe actuaries can be quite good at. So that's something that we are definitely collaborating on for a number of entities. Once you have the scenario results, what's also important is a risk and opportunities assessment. Again, quantitative and qualitative, where you identify what risks impact you and actually quantifying those risks to then understand the materiality of them so that you can then translate that to actions for the future to mitigate those risks, which is when you have to develop a climate action plan of bringing it all together, the scenarios, the risks, and the opportunities, and how would you actually adapt in the future for climate change. Risk management. Risk management and strategy go hand in hand, in my opinion. Once you have the results from the risk and opportunities assessment and also climate scenarios, that will then need to be translated into your risk management framework. You would already have one. Our recommendation is always to embed climate in that rather than coming up with a new framework that would then cause confusion. It might speak a different language. It's always best to use your current framework and incorporate the risks and opportunities in that framework so that everyone speaks the same language and everyone is on board with what the key risks are. And then if needed, that could be accompanied with an underlying risk and opportunity framework. But off the start, it's the broader risk management framework that needs to be considered in line with the results of the different analysis that need to happen. Last but not the least, metrics and targets, the most talked about, I think, the most well understood when it comes to emissions, because emissions form a big part of this pillar. Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions and Scope 3. Now, of course, Alyssa spoke about the emission categories and how Scope 1 and Scope 2 are required from the first year reporting, and Scope 3 comes in a bit later. I would say all are complex, but Scope 3 definitely very complex, and that's where I think early consideration would be quite important because there's evolving guidance in this space, specifically when it comes to injury and disability schemes or like broader insurance. The guidance is still developing, so it's very important to just be on breast with that and consider how that would work with your entity. Within metrics and targets, it's obviously emissions is a big feature of it, but I would say there's broader targets that need to be considered, not just net zero or emission targets, but how you would actually adapt to climate in future. So say weather-related events, vulnerability of your current assets, and how would that increase or decrease over time, and how would actually make your assets more resilient. So that's all also needs to be considered within this pillar. And then, of course, continuous monitoring would be, you've set a target, you need to meet that target. So continuous monitoring is very important. And finally, reporting. So that's obviously still, it's as Alyssa spoke, every state in Australia has different reporting requirements. That's quite specific to the standard that you fall under. One thing that I would say is that what we have seen help is a mock reporting or a mock disclosure. So before you actually need to release your first set of disclosure within the annual report, it helps to have a mock one, which you can take the executives and the board through so that they're across how it looks like and what the key messages are for your entity. All right, moving on. What I'll do in the next few slides is go through each of the pillars. What I'm not going to do is report tell you what the standard says, but I'm going to focus on some of the key learnings or insights that we've gained through our engagements for each of these different pillars, basically things to keep in mind. Governance. So as I said, that is top down. The very important thing about governance is organization-wide participation is quite important and very difficult to achieve. It's very difficult to get the right ears to actually listen to you. We often talk to sustainability officers who actually are well-versed with the requirements, but they're finding it very difficult to get the buy-in from the relevant stakeholders. So doing that early on is important. Having the right frameworks and processes and systems and governance over that would be the next step. Now, again, very difficult to achieve, but would set you up for success if done right at the start. And then a shared, with organization-wide participation, it also an understanding that this is a shared responsibility would help, which, again, as I said earlier, buy-in from relevant stakeholders and actually defining the roles and responsibilities across the board and accountability is important. And as always with governance, transparency in all the frameworks and in all the accountabilities, quite easy to say, difficult to achieve. Risks. So this comprises of physical risks and transition risks. I'm not going to go into the definite physical risks, is the weather-related events. Transition risk, as you transition to net zero, you or your organization is going to go through a massive change, which will, by definition, will have a lot of risks. What is less talked about, though, is the opportunities. With transitioning to net zero, there will be opportunities to consider. Where potentially actuaries can play a role is in quantifying those risks and opportunities. In my experience, a lot of research is still missing when it comes to quantifying risks and opportunities. And a lot of judgment and assumptions would be required. And disclosing those judgment and assumptions would be also required. When it comes to considering the physical risk, transition risk, and opportunities. Translating that to the injury and disability schemes, now, of course, the number and the severity of the claims will increase over time. Depending on the class of business, you might not think there's a direct impact, but there's always an indirect impact. But also reinsurance. Schemes place reinsurance. As we know, it's a very hard market. It will be more and more difficult to place reinsurance for the risks that you're insuring. And that would be important to feature in your risk registers and communicated across the board. Cross-functional capability. So again, with risks, what we've noted is a multidisciplinary team helps. So risk professionals, actuaries, finance team, reporting team all need to come together to really understand their risks, embedding that in your risk management frameworks, and then actually implementing the actions out of that. Speaking the same language is important, and reporting to board or ARC regularly has helped. Okay, climate risk scenarios. Again, something I feel actuaries can play a role in. What I think is the first thing to do when it comes to scenarios is the selection of scenarios. Now, there's RCP scenarios and SSP scenarios that you can pick from. We have noted SSP scenarios to be more broadly now implemented in the Australian space. But within SSP scenarios, of course, you have the high emission scenario, stabilization scenario, and the peak scenario. And within that also, there are a few underlying scenarios. Picking what's right for you, and also the number, do you run all? Do you run one? Do you run two? That's not an easy decision because it would take resources. It would take investment to actually run the scenarios and interpret the results of those scenarios. So picking a right scenario that you then would want to work on is very important. If I go very briefly in terms of the two ends of the scenarios, the high emission scenario essentially means you have high physical risk because not many policies have been implemented to transition to net zero or make the climate better, which means that your weather-related events, the impact of those will just increase over time. And that means that you'll have a high physical risk or high exposure to weather-related events over in the future. The lowest scenario, which is peak scenario, that basically means that the climate policies have been implemented, but they have been implemented in a quite an accelerated manner, which means that, yes, the impact of climate would reduce, but since they've been implemented in such an accelerated manner, the transition risk is high. Have you transitioned? Do you have the right governance in place as you have transitioned to net zero? What systems might break? What processes might break? Have you considered all the data aspects? So those are the two ends, and there's obviously an average stabilization scenario. So selection of scenario, what we have also noted is the selecting the horizon of the scenarios is important. Oftentimes when we go into it, we think we just pick one horizon and run that for both physical risk and transition risk. But actually picking different horizon might be more beneficial because physical risk, which is weather events, that's long term. So you need to assess that over a longer period of time compared to transition risk, which is transition to net zero, and government have targets to transition to net zero, starting 2020, 2030, 2035, 2050, based on which jurisdiction you look at, which means that that's more immediate, that's more urgent. So you need to look at that transition risk in a short to medium time frame rather and physical risk in a longer time frame. So that is, that's what we found worked quite well with our, when we were talking to the stakeholders, and that was well understood, especially in the government setting where, of course, things are quite short term and things can change quite quickly. I think setting different horizons might actually help make a meaningful impact. And then of the results of the scenarios, the road mapping, how do you actually do that in the future? Instead of just disclosing, we need to think about how to actually make a change in future.
Yeah, like how do you address those risks?
Yes.
Based on what we're seeing in terms of the actual exposure under those scenarios. Like it's one thing to see it, but it's another thing to be, how are we actually going to do something about that for our organization's sustainability?
Lastly, metrics and targets. I'm going to focus more on emissions for this pillar. What you have is a quick definition of scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. Scope 1 emissions are basically a direct emission that your entity, from the assets that your entity either controls or own. Scope 2 emissions is indirect emissions from your electricity usage. And scope 3 emissions is everything in your value chain, the upstream and the downstream activities. I would say some of the simpler examples of scope 3 for you include waste generated, employee commute, business travel, any procurement activities. Some of the complex example relate to the category 15 specifically of emissions, which is basically the injured workers or motorists in your scheme, and how do you actually account, or any assets that you might be insuring on behalf of the government, how do you actually account for all of those? That's something that's still evolving, I would say, and something to that would be quite complex to quantify over time. What I also wanted to highlight as part of emissions is data. That would play the most important role. The quality of the data, the quantity of the data, granularity of the data, completeness of the data. There's lots to unpack there. What I have on screen is just to show, and this is not an exhaustive list, just to show the different sources of data that you need to consider. Starting off with utilities, so your electricity, your gas, your fuel, your waste, your refrigerants, all of them presumably would be sitting in different systems or spreadsheets or with different providers, and that will all need to be collated in one place. Finance data, in absence of supplier-specific data, oftentimes there's precedence to use finance data, your expense data. So again, that is your finance system, and that, as we know, can be quite granular and quite extensive to work with as well. HR data and travel management system data. So your employees would be traveling for business. They would be using a separate platform again. So we're just trying to think of different sources and platforms that you need to bring together to then be able to quantify emissions. And what we have seen worked well is that data, it's best if that data comes together in one place, which is that sustainability collated data. Now that can be varied. That can be a big platform depending on the volume of data. That can be a small spreadsheet. But if it's all sitting together, that means that there is transparency in the data that you've used. And eventually when there's assurance requirements, you actually would be quite better off showcasing that this is exactly the inputs that have been used. These are the factors that have been used to actually then quantify emissions. Once you have that, then things become slightly easy, I would say, because if you've identified the data that you would be needed to quantify emissions from different scope categories. You've identified the different factors that need to be used, and then you can apply that to baseline emissions, forecast emissions in the future, consider carbon offsets, the reporting, visualization for your management, for your board, for easy translation of results. Analytics then become more streamlined and easy. And that's all I had to cover today. Alyssa is going to speak to a real-life case study.
And we might just do it quickly because I think we're getting close to the Q&A part. But we just wanted to kind of bring it all together with some of the key learnings, like as a case study of what we've seen when we've helped some of our clients. And because of the disparity across Australia in terms of where people are at, it can really be as like we've been engaged to help look at a gap assessment. So what are the key gaps that you need to fill in order to actually meet your reporting obligations? And some of the key things that we have seen as kind of pitfalls in that. So one of the key ones that and I think we kind of touched on this before, is limited board oversight and really understanding of what their obligations are and their responsibilities. So it is like an education exercise for board members as well to understand what we're actually going to have to produce. And one of the things that Sonia raised before is we've seen a lot of benefit in actually coming up with what a mock disclosure looks like so that your board and your audit and risk committee can really understand what we're actually going to have to produce to comply with AASB S2, because there is a lot in them. Like some of them are, you know, up to 20 pages plus. And it's a lot of information. Another kind of key pitfall is really around lack of controls and assurance processes. Because it's so new and because there's so many different sources of information, having clear and consistent processes in place across the business is paramount, and we've definitely seen that as a big gap. One of the things that Sonia mentioned before is sometimes our sustainability officers can be quite segregated from the rest of the business, and that's not ideal when you're trying to implement something that impacts the entire business. So we really need to make sure it's embedded, not just from a sustainability part of the business, but into the broader business. One of the other things we often see is incomplete or inconsistent data on metrics and targets. It's really hard to actually come up with meaningful information if our data is incomplete. We are at such a beginning stage in this that there are so many gaps in the data and in the consistency of the data. So that's undoubtedly been one of the biggest gaps. Kind of the next thing that we often help our clients with is around implementation plans. So how do you actually take those gaps and fill them, and what does the time horizon look like for that? Everyone acknowledges that we are at very early stages, so it's not going to be perfect from the beginning, but how do we kind of set meaningful implementation plans? Key to the success of that, number one, governance structure. So how do we actually allocate responsibility across the business for this and make sure that people are accountable and have buy-in? As we mentioned throughout, data collection is messy. It's coming from so many different sources from within your organization. So developing a really consistent process for collecting data and making sure you have controls over that as well is really important. One of the things that I will say cannot be underplayed is the amount of training that needs to go into this. And that goes from your board and exec level all the way down into the business itself. This is a really new topic for everyone, so there's going to need to be organizational-wide training on it. And then lastly, for those that have already kind of been well down the journey towards climate reporting, and I know, Stuart, you mentioned before, you've had to start reporting on it already. One of the big things that I would say, it's not a set and forget. Even a lot of the assumptions that go into kind of scenario analysis, they're changing so rapidly that it needs a continual monitoring as well. Also, because we're starting with such a low base around our data collection, like, there's so much we can do to make it a lot more robust and meaningful. And that's the thing, is it should be something that you are continuously looking at.
And it's funny, a few people, when we talk about accounting standard change, are like, what's the value in this? Like, you know, it's probably so much cost for an organization to implement this. And you know, I think we've talked a lot about that a lot on AASB 17, for example. But this is one where I am very passionate about it, because without accountability, and which comes from reporting, we are not going to see a reduction in emissions, because people will not be held accountable. And I think that's something that I am like, there is so much benefit in this, and it's so much more than an accounting standard. It's a change in the way that we run our businesses. So I'll stop there and hand over to questions.
Let's thank the listener and Sonia for the insightful practical presentation. Yeah. So we've got about 5 minutes. I haven't heard the bell ring yet for some questions, and yeah, would love to get some. Feel free. We've got a mic up there, and I'm sure Alyssa and Samia would love to hear from you. But you can feel free to drop some questions in the iPad. So yeah, do we have any questions? Yeah, feel free to come up.
There's quite a few. I suppose I'll just go with one of them.
That's great, Tim.
So one question to start.
Just in terms of reporting for emissions, how do you standardise that across different times of day? So, for example, if there's a lot of solar power that's used during the peak hours, would that be different to emissions, say, during late nights, if there's usage during then instead?
Yeah, I mean, your electricity usage would reflect that, and then the emissions would then reflect that based on your usage. On the electricity, yes, exactly. Yep.
Yep.
One question. Are you seeing any systems that are being used to collect the data?
Yes. It's quite a broad range, depending on the volume of data that you have. There's quite a few different tech platforms in the market, which would then be used to collate the data. You could always go in-house to, like, move all your data to cloud, which is obviously a trend. But depends, if you have small volumes, then even a spreadsheet would do. So there's a very broad range, and it's quite bespoke to the volume of the data that you have and what you also eventually would like to do with it.
And one thing I was going to say on that is that because of the kind of stage of maturity that we're at, it's probably good to just see what happens with the market in terms of technology and not jump into something too quickly. I remember when we had the new leasing accounting standard, there were so many different platforms that were released. And to be honest, I think it was found that a lot of them were not great. So I would just err on the side of caution with any thing that seems too good to be true. And at the end of the day as well, your data that goes into that is the most important, like getting that right is way more complicated than actually like a platform that's going to pretest to run some sort of, calculation.
We have time for one more question, and I'm happy to ask it. So Alyssa, you talked about how, you know, effectively this is a big journey that all entities will need to grapple with. You mentioned some jurisdictions, Commonwealth and New South Wales, that are leading the way. But which organisations and entities, you mentioned there's one example where it's effectively live now. Who's doing it really well? And who can we look to in terms of leadership?
There's definitely some New South Wales government entities that are doing it quite well. And I feel like we're going to start to see examples of that in annual reports. I don't know if I'd list any off the top of my head, though, just because of the stage that they're at. Yeah, it's not released yet. But yeah, it will be this year. New South Wales Treasury does have a lot of guidance on it, which I have, like, I, to be honest, I'm very impressed by the amount of work that they've done around it. So I think that that's a good place to start, is looking at New South Wales Treasury guidance in terms of what best practice is. But as I said, it's like all well and good to have like a pro forma of what you want the disclosures to look like. The data that goes in there is what is going to be really challenging. And that's one thing. It's like Samia and I get to work so closely together, actuarial and accounting, because it is such an important thing to have together. I mean, I can tell you what you need to do to be compliant, but I need an actuary to tell me how I'm going to quantify those key risks and measure against the targets that we're setting.
We can feel the passion. It just leaves us all to thank Lissa and Samyar again for the presentation.